What are you guys talking about?
Okay, welcome. Live. Bienvenue.
Another, live, Michael.
Day, another dollar on what are you guys talking about? We have the lovely Michael James Dean with us here today.
Hello. Was that your jingle there? Was that?
That was the intro that we record live every single time.
You do it again for me.
What are you guys talking about?
I'm a one and done.
What are you guys talking about?
There you go.
It is now Michael and my show, and it's so good having you all those years.
All right. Goodbye. My last episode.
I do feel like it would be like with me, and you know, it would really be like the SNL bye bye. Do you ever remember that when it was like bye bye? When did you say bye
bye? Bye bye. Yes, welcome, Michael, the great and powerful Oz, as far as I'm concerned, the man behind the curtain, who we were very, very lucky to collaborate with. Jason, why don't you tell the story about how you kind of were told about this magical unicorn that is Michael James Dean?
Okay, yeah, no, that was... That's mouth. Yeah, that's a good mouth story. So I know another guy named Nicholas Burnham Vince, who also has a podcast, The Chatterer Hour, Chattering Hour. Anywho, he's the chatterer. He's the guy who played the chatterer in the Hellraiser films. He was also in Nightbreed, knows Clive Barker well, and is just generally like in the horror scene.
He's the man, right?
And maybe that's kind of how he's made a name for himself, because he's always in my friend's films now because he just volunteers. Like he'll, you know, it's not like he'll do it for free all the time, but, you know, he will be in a lot of indie directors. And he's incredibly, incredibly supportive of the London and the overall English. And maybe, you know, generally because we do work, you know, with Scotland a lot as well, the general like UK horror scene. Yeah. And that's how I know him, because I used to go to Fright Fest. I still go to Fright Fest, but I used to go and hang out with the people he hangs out with. We got to talking, as I do to everyone, and we became friends because he's actually based out of Croydon. So I bought him ice cream a bunch of times because he's bought me ice cream, and we've had ice cream fun and coffee fun and just general Croydon fun. But he knew years ago that I was trying to get into production, and he liked my enthusiasm. It's one of the few things I had going for me back then that people thought, wow, he's really enthusiastic about being a producer. So, and luckily Katie Bonham gave me a good write-up for the work I did with her on MAB. So he had talked, and I was looking for people to collaborate with. So he said, you know, I got this friend named Michael James Dean. Here's his details. You might just want to get in touch with him. I think the two of you would get along really well. And Michael's trying to get some things started. He's got some ideas. So, you know, I'm not even really sure how I contacted Michael after that. I think it was pretty much just an email. Can we have a coffee and can I meet you then? But that's how it all started. And from there came Shredders.
And we went to like a really, really hipstery coffee place in Croydon. Yeah, I remember.
Very tiny little one.
tiny little shop. And I remember like we met you there, and I was like, oh, this guy's so cool. This is like the kind of coffee shop that he frequents. Oh my God, I love it. But
it was all a front after that.
And yeah, exactly. And then I realized that total bullshit. This man will have a dirty builder's tea any day of the week.
To be fair, you know, when I sold him on the concept of the LVP logo, we were also at a trendy coffee shop he'd never been to before.
Right. Yeah.
It's the way to get something past Ed, be like, yeah, we're going to do it this way.
But yeah, that's where you kind of first laid out your idea for Shredders, which I think like we both just immediately were like, what? Okay. How did you describe it to us then, Michael?
Oh gosh, as a 1980s creature film, British, Gremlins meets Shaun of the Dead.
You know. And can I just say, at that point, like I would have sucked you off, like without any issues.
That's what you did. That's how we got the gig. Yeah.
I wasn't gonna reveal it on air, but like, because immediately, like I could see it, and I thought it was such a brilliant idea, and I couldn't quite understand why anyone had not done it, to be honest with you.
No, I mean, I think that was the first thing that ran through both of our heads when you told us the concepts and kind of what was going on. It's like Critters meets Gremlins, but with a new vibe. And the thing that got me once I read the script, and Mike, why I love working with you, is your ability on timing for English comedy is just, you know, as I said, I see a lot of scripts. I'm very lucky that way, that people come to me and say, can you tell me what you think of the script? I love that. Please, everyone, continue to do that like crazy. But that's what I mean. Like, out of everything I read, Mike, like, I love your timing. And that's why I was like, I have to work with this guy, because, do you know what I mean? Like, he definitely gets how to say the English joke. And it's different than American jokes. So, like, that's something I've talked about with Ed. Is like, can we get him to do American comedy? I'm not sure. We should try it. You know, see? Because it's slightly, all the timing is slightly different. But you would definitely nail this kind of, like, jumper, Christmas jumpers going around, you know, office party gone wrong, you know, with the 80s vibe. I could see it. Like Ed said, I could totally see it. And then you were ambitious. Like, you came to us and were like, and I've got a feature script for this. And it was like,
it's a feature.
It's another thing that we're used to, because, you know, thanks to London Horror Society, shout out to you guys, you know, and a bunch of other people. We talk to people about how to get their features made. We don't usually help you past telling you what things you need to do. And then you go off and find people have money and go bother them, you know, as opposed to us. But, you know, you had a really great feature concept as well on that, except when I went to Paul Weil, who's like special effects guy now working at Chipotle Studios, I think, but generally a nice horror guy, so shout out to Paul. And I told him he might want animatronics, like that's when his jaw hit the floor. And it was right.
And I think that's the answer to the question why no one had done it before.
That was it.
Because it's probably just insanely expensive.
Well, who knows? Because now you have, and it's funny, you know, people we want to get on the podcast might, like, there's another guy in Book of Monsters, another Nick Burnham Vince film. He plays the father in that one. It was Stuart, I'm going to say Stuart Little, because I like the book. Sorry, I think it's Stuart Light or Stuart Lytle. Sorry, I'm getting your name wrong horribly, but you're awesome. Like, he made a creature feature on an indie budget. Like, I don't know what his budget was, and I've never been able to sit down and talk to him about it, but I will at some point. And so he would be a good idea for us looking at how do we pitch Shredders as a feature to some degree. Yeah. But when it came down to it, that's why, listeners, that's why we ended up settling and convincing Michael to a certain degree to do a short film instead. And that's kind of how the whole adventure started for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we go too much further, though, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background in film, though? Because telling you honestly, Mike, on the podcast, I'm always amazed. We've had so many different, like, walks of life that come on here and work with us that I'm always interested to hear the backstory. Like, how did you get into film? How is it like that you're doing this now?
Well, when I was at school, I did drama for GCSE, and I did a play at Christmas, I think it was, and I wrote this little comedy sketch about these two families. One half of the stage was the rich family and one was the poor family. I think I played the rich dad, who was obsessed with Versace and things, and we did it in assembly and people absolutely loved it. And I came out of that, and the girl that I absolutely was obsessed with at high school, this girl to me was like, "You're amazing. That's amazing. You're brilliant." And I thought, you know what? I think I can try and be an actor here.
I think I've cracked it.
I obviously already loved film anyway. My first memory was going to see Jurassic Park, and
of course,
with my dad, and him sort of showing me this film that created dinosaurs out of nothing. And for me, that's probably the most special moment I have with him, is going to that and seeing these things come to life. And I think that was my...
How old were you when you saw...
It was 93, wasn't it? So
yeah, something like that.
86, 4, 7, 7, 8, something like that.
Wow. Okay, so it's like just seared in your memory, because that's about the age where, you know, things start to... Which is interesting, because that's Catherine's age now, isn't it, Jason?
It is.
Now the movies that you expose it to at this age are probably going to be the ones that, like, really kind of inspire us. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely. And then following that, I studied at college, and then I went to university to study drama. Again, I just wanted to be an actor. I'd always wanted to do that. I enjoyed it.
Is that something... Sorry to interrupt, but is that something that you... So had you done plays before kind of doing drama GCSE? Was drama GCSE like, oh, that's an easy subject because that's why I chose it, I'll be honest with you. Or was it like, oh, you'd kind of caught the bug earlier?
Oh, I definitely caught the bug earlier. I mean, I played the head of the Chinese dragon in primary school in a play, you know. That was the start. And then even in the year seven, me and some friends, we got a video camera together and we made a 50-minute movie that I wrote and then forgot the script on the day and rewrote the script off the top of my head.
Oh, my God. Have you still got that?
No, because it was on old school tape, you know, like TV, and it just got lost to the ether. And it, so I'd started doing it then, and just, you know, picking up a video camera and messing around and trying to make people laugh and things. And I'd always quote films. I think Aladdin. I used to quote the genie to my dad all the time, or anything with Jim Carrey, and was always like my thing. So I think when it came to the chance of doing it as a GCSE and thinking, well, I get to do this as something, I think I just went with it. And I think at that point, I just thought, I definitely want to make some career out of this. And I wanted to obviously be an actor at that point. So it wasn't until university where I started writing plays that I sort of discovered that side of things more and felt that my scripts had a different edge than just because I'd done acting.
Coming from that point of view, I completely can see that. And so did you take like a script writing course, or was it just something that you kind of started just doing?
So the degree I took had a bit of everything, really. So I had directing, acting, acting was the main part of it, but writing was in there as well. And then a group of really great friends that were also creatives at the time, we sort of banded together and everyone started writing their own stuff, and we just put things on outside because we just wanted to do more than just what we were doing in the course.
That's cool.
And then I think in 2008 I wrote a play called One on One, which went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival with the university, along with the three or four other plays, short play. I got to go there with them for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, which was amazing. Actually met Ricky Payne.
Ricky.
Shout out to Ricky. Yeah, that's where I met him. And then after that, graduated university. The group of people that I'd met at university, we started a company funded by Darren Furness, who directed Shredders. And it was all about new writing, so I got a chance to act and write in that as well.
Nice. And just to clarify, Ricky, because we just like were like, yay, Ricky. But he was the DOP on Shredders. And he was a trooper carrying that cameraman. That taking it off at the end, I helped him take it off.
That was that was a steady cam, right? That he had to wear at certain times, right?
It was one of those easy rigs, wasn't it?
Yeah, easy rig.
Yeah. And so you have like a vest and the camera hangs from a wire. And he wore it all day. Like during his breaks, he was wearing it. And I helped him take it off at the end of the day, man. And that was just funk. Yeah. It was like, and I gave him a big hug.
Yeah, that was the great thing about the Shredder's shoot. I still remember us all piling into that fucking car.
The car.
There's a lot of funk going on in that car, but it was like, it was so cool to see everybody that way. You know what I mean?
We got close. Yeah. It was very brotherly.
That was part of the reason, again, that we wanted to collaborate with you, Mike, because talking about these people, like the other thing we noticed, and this is for the listeners, because we have a lot of, you know, indie filmmaker listeners, Mike, people that are like us, they're out there kind of trying to learn on their as they go along as well. And, you know, the biggest thing you notice about other people that are at least doing something right about is they have people they work with continuously coming back to them, and they have contact to these things. And I'm saying this as a guy who doesn't have many of these things yet, so I'm telling you how important they really are in you, because that's part of the fun we're having with You Reap What You Sow is, I don't have a ton of contacts. We have a few. You know what I mean? And we're definitely, you know, going through the list as it were. But.
And one of the things of working with you as well, and I've worked on other shoots with people over the years, is building that, right? Building that like kind of network almost.
Yeah.
But you seem to have like a really great, like I remember, was it Helena Jung who was your script supervisor, and she was like on point, man. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a script supervisor quite that good. And you had Jamie, who was a gaffer and doing the lighting as well. Who else? Who am I forgetting?
The crew had Lee Viesnik, who was our sound guy.
Oh yeah, Lee. Yeah, who fell asleep. He would fall asleep between setups.
He knew exactly how to do it.
I know. And he'd have his gear ready and we'd be like, Lee. And then he'd be up and ready.
That was Shredders was probably the biggest crew I've had. So we had, you know, John Lee in post production. We had Felipe, there's so many people.
People. Yes, check the IMDb listeners.
I've worked with so many different people on my various different shorts, and I think. I have been lucky that I found people that are the same as me. They're passionate, but they're also very kind of, I wouldn't say chilled out, but that they understand that when it's time to get going, they get going and they enjoy that part of it. But I always try to make sure that my sets are always a fun place to be, because I think if everyone's having fun, they can be creative. I think there's no point in running down set to people that I know what's going on. And if you're there for 16 hours or something like that, nobody wants producer or something like that.
This is some of the things I still feel really new about, Mike, because for me, you know, having talked and sat with guys like Sash Kassoon, who's been on a lot of big sets and things like that, they'll talk to you about those like really bad sets. And I haven't been on one yet because I've only done indie and I've only really done a couple sets that I've been on. And that's what I mean. Like the one we were on with you, completely chilled. You know what I mean?
It was fun.
Like, we just had to do it that way. And so, the you know, I think...
Although I will say that when we got to, like, the last few hours, I think everyone was just so tired. Everyone had given so much of their energy. And like you say, you know, a lot of, like, everyone had kind of come with their A game and stuff. But I remember just being so tired for the next week and a half.
I think you might have said it when we were there, but I always think if you create a good environment and people are passionate and you're good to people on set and before set and after as well, if you're there like we were and there was those few extra shots that needed to be done, you know, I didn't have to ask people to stay.
No,
they did,
let's do them. That, let's get them done.
And that for me was a really sort of humbling experience to know that they were.
I remember you got teary-eyed a couple of times during that shoot.
I did, yeah. I couldn't see by the end of that shoot, so I don't know if people were happy because my eyes were absolutely pouring from the lights that we had there. But
No, it was a great experience. But let's go back again we were talking about your uni. You started writing and stuff like that.
So after a few years with the theatre company, we all kind of realised that it was quite a difficult industry to get into, especially with new writing and things. We kind of went our separate ways, and I thought, oh, I'll come back to London and I'll try acting in the big smoke. It didn't go well. I think
it's a tough life, right? The auditioning
I mean, I didn't like that. I'm terrible at auditions. I would go into auditions and I think I had sweat patches from my armpit down to my waist because I just sweated. That was like my thing. And I'd walk in.
That was my thing.
They'd go, they'd come in and they'd say, "Ah, oh, here he is. Here's Mike. Yeah.
What's up, sweaty Mike?
You've not got a job." No, I haven't got a job, but it's been a nice day out. And I just didn't like going in and kind of having someone, half the time the director was never there, and it was just like, no, you've already decided when you come in. And, you know, I take my hat off to people that can do that.
Well, you're so beholden to other people to express your art, right? Like, you have to get past these gatekeepers.
Yeah.
No,
I totally hear you, because people, God knows, in my own family, you know, this is the big from my dad's side, because I mean, I was out in California. My dad used to work with people from Paramount. You know, I have friends from MGM, and my parents are like, you're 38 years old and just decided that you wanted to do this. What's going on? And it was like, well, the problem is when you go to LA and you see California, it's the gatekeepers, like you said. And I never, even though I hung out with people that worked in the industry, it was like, you know, acting, I just never thought, like, my sister was the attractive one. I was like, I'm never going to be good looking enough. I didn't know that if you worked hard enough, you didn't have to be a good looking person. You could be a normal person, be an actor. But like, to me, it was like gatekeepers will never accept me on a role for anything. And then when it came to the rest of Hollywood, it was the same kind of way, Ed. So it was like, well, why bother with this? Because you're beholden, you know, to someone else. You could have the greatest idea in the world, which is how I always thought about my writing I would be, you know, because I'm just that egotistical, you know, but it's like, but you'll have it and then someone else will take it and do what they want with it. And I just couldn't live with that. It was like, that's stupid. Why would I pursue that? Now I have a completely different view of it now, but I totally, it just triggered that when you said that, because
But I think a lot of that, I think, is the indie vibe. And like you're saying, you know, we've been lucky. Most of the sets that we've worked on, you know, have been just joyous experiences, even though it's been fucking hard work and, you know, stress and all those things that come with it. But at the end of it, it's so fulfilling. And you know, just to kind of jump back to Shredders a little bit, we're going to keep going backwards and forwards, I think. But, you know, the moment of sitting at Horror on Sea and seeing it like on the big screen and stuff, it brings such joy to me. It really kind of fires my serotonin in my brain, and I just... You know, I feel great. So but
that's an interesting connection too, Ed, because Horror on Sea is the first time we met Richard.
Yeah. Which, and I didn't even realize. I was like, oh, dude, hey, what's up,
man? You know what I mean? And it's like, that's just the awesome thing about indie. It's that whole organic feel that just cuts against, I'm sure it was there in LA and I just never saw it, to be honest with you. But it cuts against everything that I didn't like about film before. Because I've always liked the films themselves. Like, like that. That's how Ed and I started getting along, because we just both love film. But the idea that you can go in and kind of create that and kind of make your own project. You know, we say this all the time. Like, people call us up and say, well, I've got this idea for a feature. I want to make it, but I want to make it this way and I want to do it this way. And you say to them, you say, listen, if you have a very specific way you want to make the feature, then you got to make it as cheap as possible, right? You've got to literally make it for as, you know, whatever you can get together, because the minute you bring other people in and their money is the minute you start losing control over some of those things.
And it gets more and more complicated. And like, it's funny because, you know, we've been talking about You Reap What You Sow with Mike just before we got on Mike and stuff. And, you know, like, I know that if I just asked a bunch of friends and we went on, do you know what I mean? And I took my cameras, we could just shoot it, right? But you want to reach a certain level. You want to, you know, push every project that you do has to be better than the next one. And, you know, like it can be frustrating, but it's also kind of the joy of you know, the whole journey and stuff. But I am curious, Mike, when it comes to, So you kind of transitioned from acting into writing. And you did study a bit of directing and stuff like that. Was that always your kind of like, okay, I'm heading towards directing? Was that your idea?
No, I think I've met a lot of people that are far better directors than I think I could ever be. But when I sort of started moving behind the camera, I started my company in 2013, and I was working with people like Scott Lias, who I acted in one of his short films, and he helped me on my first short film. I started to see people behind the camera, and I always said to myself, well, if I want to make things, it's going to be cheaper at the start to kind of give certain things a go, and if I feel I can direct it, then I'll direct it.
So it was kind of like step by step, you were just kind of like inching towards it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I've ever kind of wanted to be a director, but if there's something that I feel in my head that I can see and that no one else could create it how I see it, especially if I've written it, then of course I'll direct it. And that was the case with Already Dead.
Yes.
You know, there was...
Which is the first of your films that I saw, which I fucking loved. I love me zombie shit. Again, like, you know, Shaun of the Dead immediately, you know, came to mind. And it's also obviously where, you know, we get the wonderful Dick from...
Mr. Rustin, Darren
Rustin. Yes, Darren. Oh. Yeah. He's like Darren. Another glorious find.
But Darren has been in everything I've made from my first film.
Like we talk about with Sophie, Mike, he's a hidden gem. You know, he's another one that, like, you could stick him up there next to, like, Peter Kay and a bunch of other things in each.
Yeah, totally. He would. But go
toe-to-toe. It hasn't been discovered yet. So that's why, like, I know I always sound like this to people that work with me as a producer, but that's what our job is about finding people that are actually quite talented at what they do that other people don't know yet. Because... unfortunately, because that's how we get them on the cheap to start out.
You know? Exactly. Exactly. That's how we get them cheap.
He's amazing. You know, I've seen him in all your stuff, and I just, like, that guy's comedy gold. Like, everything he's in, he makes me laugh.
Yeah, he's such a nice person as well. He's just a likable person off screen and on screen. I think people instantly see him, and they just like him. It doesn't matter if he is a dick or if he is...
And that was the great thing about him, because I saw him in Already Dead, where he plays a zombie, right? Who's kind of being interviewed after the zombie apocalypse.
Yep.
And it's like a kind of BBC or ITV kind of show. Yeah, and he's living his life as a zombie and he's trying to adjust and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's so funny. Like, the way he's speaking, you can't understand him half the time.
Yeah.
But it just gets funnier and funnier and funnier. And then juxtapose that with the role of Dick, which is, like, I think of Die Hard. And I think of, do you know who I'm talking about? The prick who's at the party, who's hitting on Holly Gennaro. Do you know what I mean? He's playing that role. Yeah, the cokehead, yeah. He's like, Hans, Bubby.
Hans, come on! Yeah.
And he does that so well. And like, but I think, and this is my prediction for Darren, I think that he's going to wow someone with a dramatic performance. Because he's got that kind of pathos to him that I really, really like. So
there's a sadness as well in the fact that he's so likable.
That's where I see, like, the Englishness in him. The way I could put him in a lineup for, like, English comedy or English drama, like you said, and he would fit just into that piece so well and so easily. But the other thing, like you said, Ed, and this is, I'm a big stickler about, just because, you know, I don't ever really see the need with demand as high as it is in the film industry. I don't see the need for assholes on set. Now, I am not the expert. Okay. I am not the guy that has the job working with the expert actors, but even then I question, because I say, it is such a flooded market. Can't we just find normal people to work with? Do we need, because I work in an environment that's very much, very similar to that. It's highly competitive, you know, and there are people that are cool and there are people not cool. And you get to a point in that career where you don't have to work with assholes anymore, because there's just so much competition. You can fire the ones that, you know what I mean? That just don't gel in your team and things like that. And so, you know, that's the other thing about Darren. We had a lot of work for him to do on set, and he was such a trooper and such a nice guy, and before and after set as well. That's how I know him better, is because I'm always the one that's trying to do crazy promotion stuff, and he is always out there trying to help the share campaign, you know, do the stuff that's what I need from my actors. You know, I need them to kind of do that extra bit. Why? Because that's how we get the film sold. That's how we get things out the door, is by promoting it, by showing what cool people we have working on it.
And the big actors, a lot of them get paid big money for promotion.
We did the analysis on Transcendence, okay? So it's not like I'm making this up, listeners. Like, we did an analysis on Transcendence, and one of the biggest problems in the line item budget we looked at in that big production was buying Johnny Depp. And that's because Johnny Depp was not worth the $50 million they paid him. Not because he's a bad guy or a bad actor, but because as a star actor, he does not carry
right.
that kind of quality with him. He does not carry people. And that's all I'm trying to say about Darren. Darren, of course, is much earlier on in his career, you know, is not that Johnny Depp status, but that is the kind of guy that can grow into something really big because he's willing to go that extra mile for his audience and for his through the people he works for. Sorry, I just wanted to say that because I was really impressed by Darren on that. And I'm not always impressed. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's like, oh, okay, they did a great performance, but I don't think we'll use him again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think on that point, you get as an actor, there's a lot of people in the career industry, you do get told, you know, you got to look out for yourself, make sure it's about you. And that does breed this idea of, I don't care about anyone else. It's about me and I need these opportunities, which I get that competitive side of it. But actually, I'd rather spend my life being a good producer and a good person working with good people.
Working with people you like.
Never make it. And I'd still die happy because I'd know that I'd made something by not being an arsehole.
I'm with you.
I mean, this is the thing I think that is sometimes fundamentally misunderstood about the film industry. As an industry, as a business, like, if you put mechanisms into an industry that are hurtful, that aren't good in the long term, they will come back to bite you. And I think film is a great example of them having done that. They built a celebrity culture that turns in on itself now. They have built
auditioning that we were talking about. You know, it breeds competition between
actors.
Film
isn't exclusive to this. I've done watching The Neon Demon, which I love. I just love the visuals of that film. It's a very visual film, but it's all about the fashion industry and how that eats itself, so to speak. Then you have production styles that are more based on the bottom line dollar for shareholders than they are on the art and things like that. And that all comes from breeding this attitude of look out for yourself. And I just don't think, like, Ed, you were one of the first people that taught me how art could be different. You know what I mean? How
communal. I'm a commie.
Something amazing. You know, it may not look as amazing as something that was $1 million, but you can make something amazing just with the goodwill of other people, you know, just by relying on favors. And to me, that product is infinitely better, you know, infinitely better than anything Hollywood can produce. And so that's, I don't know, it's part of the reason we get you on the show, Mike, because we know you kind of buy into that too, that you hear us when we say that.
Yeah, well, I always think you want to be someone that people want to work with again and again, because that's the true test of whether or not you've done well for your team. And that's never, as a producer, it's never about me. It's about the team and the successes that I feel are, like when we went to the Horror on Sea, or when I show off a screening and I see the other people that have been involved excited.
It's a good feeling.
You know, I my excitement comes from getting an initial idea. That's where
this is why we need to get you playing more D&D, because you get it. It's the same thing. It's the same feeling.
Well, I would love to have Michael involved in that. That's kind of another, you know, we were talking about before we did the podcast, we were telling him kind of about business, and Dirty 20 is, I would say, one of our fastest growing areas because of the popularity of D&D, because, you know, people are playing now. But it's also because we've seen it as like a story medium. And so, Michael, like, what we mean is, like, we don't understand why people aren't taking these games and turning them into films. Like, that simple. Because we're doing it with everything else. You know, you turn everything else into a TikTok video or a YouTube video or something like that. Like, why aren't people sitting at the table playing one of these games and then picking that story up and saying, what can we make to do this, to show this? And do we get animators in? So I'd love to kind of sit down with you at some point and pick your brain on that, because we want to get like a workshop for that. Like, we had even a thought of opening a store just so we can get people's ideas to produce them in a studio in the back. But do you know what I mean? Like, that's the idea. It's like getting some sort of creative vibe going so we can churn out some cool stuff for YouTube or something, you know?
For sure. I also wanted to, I don't know why I said also twice there, but, you know, take it as you may.
You must really want to know.
Yeah. Also, so you did like a web series, right?
Yes.
Which was Cupid.
Yeah,
that's right. And also brilliant. You guys can check it out on YouTube. How was that? Because I think it's always something that you know, Jason and I have talked about, like doing something serialized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how was that for you? Would you recommend going the web series way or not?
I think the way content is now, it's slightly different. Back when we did that web series, things like Netflix and stuff were popular, but they weren't turning out as much content as they do now. So kind of web series was like a slight indie thing of TV on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's quick, fast content and tutorials and how-tos and things are more popular. Mm. But for me personally, there are a lot of things in that series that I did wrong, that I got wrong. And I think if I hadn't gotten wrong, I probably wouldn't have gone on to do the right thing afterwards.
Interesting. So it was a real learning experience.
Yeah, so we initially did a short to launch Gosh Dinosaur, which was called I'm with Cupid, and it was just the two main characters meeting in a park, and it was done, you know, people really enjoyed it, and I said, well, I'd like to do more with that. And then I met a friend I'd known at school, but we hadn't spoken for ages, called Abdul Chowdhury, and he was working at the time with sort of distribution company as an intern for films and stuff, and he always loved writing and things, so he found out that I was working on films and just said, oh, do you want to meet up? And we said, well, why don't we do this web series? And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to. He'd worked as the runner on the initial short.
Right.
He was like, let's make a series, let's do more of that. And I said, well, would you like to help me produce it? Yeah, I'd love to. So my goal then was just to create something that had a story arc throughout. Mm-hmm. A lot of people had made web series and they were kind of one
bitty
episode. So it was the same character, but it was just a different
thing. Just episodic,
I wanted to create something that had that arc throughout. And the idea was that we would create it month on month, which was probably one of the hardest things we've ever done, because it was consistently, you'd do the one episode and then it'd be, right, we've got to cast for the next episode, we've got to get right. Where our location.
Churn it out, yeah, right? Almost like that TV schedule grind, right?
Yeah. And it was like, I don't think there was many times when I wasn't working that I wasn't either filming something or writing something or rewriting the next episode, changing it because someone couldn't do it. I made choices in it as a director. I was a director, producer, and actor in it, which was difficult, which was really difficult. Because you have to trust everyone behind the camera, and I did trust Ricky was the OP on that. I did trust him behind the camera, but at the same time, you're not fully in it all the time, and you can't.
Because your mind is kind of somewhere else. Yeah, it's one of the things we've talked about often, about the difficulty of taking on multiple roles and stuff.
Yeah, and at that time we just had a DSLR. We didn't have monitors and all the different things that I'd be able to play back and look at or anything like that. We sort of carried on doing that. I really liked it. I was really proud of the fact there was a through line, there was characters, it was solid in that sense. We then decided to do the final episode. We took a month or two, and I said, I want to make a full, you know, 20-odd minute, as if it would be on TV.
Long short kind of thing,
As what a normal episode would be. And that's probably the proudest I am of that, is because that final episode, and I've watched it in the last year, I think, you know, I'm really proud of that, because it almost feels like you could see what I'd done throughout.
The progress,
And then... if I hadn't done Cupid, I don't think I'd have had the understanding to then trust my instincts were already dead.
Interesting. So very, very trial by fire then, right? You know, putting yourself through the paces. And obviously it wasn't the first thing you directed. No. But, I mean, you were essentially showrunner, lead writer, director, producer, and actor. I mean, did you have budgets for at all, or?
I had some of my own money, and then occasionally Abdul would help out as well where he could. And I mean, I don't think I'd have been able to do it without the team, but also without Abdul himself. And it was, he still says to me now that it was a learning curve for him, because he, before that, he wanted to be a writer, and we did Cupid, and I said, do you know what, I think you could be a producer, I think you could help people here, and he's now working in LA as a producer, and, you know, and he's gone from strength to strength.
And you are to blame.
I know, I apologise if you're listening.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah, I'm really proud of him, and I think that's, you know, that's the best thing you can see for anyone that you've worked with, is that they go on to do really well, because that's just
right. And then after that, that's when you had the feature for Shredders, right? That's when you kind of developed that.
Yeah, yeah. So after Already Dead, I mean, I wrote quite a few different feature films.
Did you sell any, or?
No, so I put them into competitions and, you know, various placings.
Would you recommend that for people? Like, you know, write a script, send it to a competition, even if you've got to pay a little fee or something?
If you like writing, if you want to be a writer, because ultimately that's out of all of the roles, that and producing are the two that I absolutely adore. Mm-hmm. I think it is really good to do that, because you get a kind of barometer for where your writing's at. And yeah. I would enter competitions like, if you know the website Screencraft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I've entered theirs and placed in quarterfinals a couple of years and in a row, and you kind of get this feeling of, right, okay, that's where I am. Next time, maybe I'll go up, and you can kind of test. And there are some, I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of the festival was or the competition, but they gave you feedback, and they gave you solid feedback. And I think that you get that from a lot of writing competitions, is that feedback that you maybe don't necessarily get from entering into the film competition. You know,
they've got right. things
to look for. So I think it's really beneficial. You know, yes, you could win things and stuff like that, but I think they do give me the confidence to say, hey, I know that this script has something because someone else has read it.
Right.
Read a lot of scripts and gets it.
And right. do you tend to, do you tend to first show it to, you know, collaborators, family, friends, before you send it off for like competitions? So it's like another step in the process of refinement is what
I'm saying. Definitely. I mean, it goes through a few drafts and re-edits and things like that before it gets to that stage. I think I have people like yourselves that I'm happy to send to. I have other friends that I know will be honest with me. And all picked up on your instincts. Again, you know, it's your script, it's your film. If someone's making a film, you can easily listen to everyone else, but I always tell myself, if I give it to 10 people and those 10 people all say the same thing, I've got a problem. But if they're all saying something different, then that's personal preference. And you kind of have to learn to pick and choose from that, because I have done in the past. I've let other people listen to other people and kind of
be influenced.
Looked back and gone, you know what?
I should have stuck to my guns.
Yeah, that joke would have worked better. One thing you may have noticed when you've worked with me, and that I don't like, is being told when a joke's not funny that I know is funny. Especially with scripts, because I have it all the time. And I think even you guys slightly did it in Shredders.
Oh, we love you though.
Where
we don't know how to write comedy though, man. Like genuinely, it was like
Margaret Thatcher, because I still thought the Peggy from Margaret Thatcher. I was like, you had to sell me on that point, the Peggy from Margaret Thatcher. So I was like, oh, Peggy from Reception. Like, that's what Peggy would be working.
Well, but it ends up giving you a good light here, guys. So this isn't a slam at all.
You're not shitting on us.
No. So the way I write is, obviously I can hear a joke, and it's really hard sometimes to get that across on a page. And, you know, I think even Judd Apatow, for example, writes 20 different jokes for one line. Then when he gets on set, if an actor comes up with another three or four, he writes them down. He has like a book of these jokes.
Right.
But ultimately he knows what's going to be funny or not. And I think it was some of the stuff that Dick did in Shredders. And I think you both said, I think he's going to come across this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I said to both of you, don't worry, it will.
I know best.
Different to how it's going to be acted, and that's the hardest thing.
And you were so right. And you were so right.
That's some of the best lines I come from when they're delivered by Darren. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's why I find it difficult that when I give someone a script and they read it, I always want to talk to them afterwards, because they may be like, I don't know if this line works. And actually, if I explain it, and you have to always see it in the comedy and the way I work, then right. they go, oh, now I get it.
But that's why it's so hard though with comedy, mm. because it is very kind of subjective in tone, in mm. inflection, you know, and so to be able to have that in your head, I think that's really, really good. I mean, it just goes to show why your comedic timing is on point.
It's difficult as a writer. I've learned a lot from the continuous scripts that I've written and gone back and being quite meticulous over my own work and realizing that you have to use all the elements that you have at your disposal. I've read, just like you guys, I'm sure I've read a lot of scripts that are just not sort of hit well, formatted well. And the thing that changed my mind was someone said, you're not writing a film to be filmed at that stage. You're writing it to be read. And that was really hard to understand at first. But as soon as you think someone's got to sit down in front of this piece of paper and read this, mm. how do I get them to see these words in their head exactly how I want them to, in a way that also makes them feel like they're being creative with it, especially if you're going to give it to a director. So I think Darren said to me when he read Shredders that he could see it as a director because I hadn't put in everything. I hadn't put in Fade to Black, left.
Right.
All these sort of things.
Which I'm totally guilty of doing that shit. I will admit that.
But that's probably because so many indie filmmakers are writing it to
write the director.
That's what I was going to say. And come on, like, I love my writing, but my writing is always written as if I'm the one that's going to make it. You know?
Yeah.
That's one of the biggest flaws with it, because exactly what Mike's saying, like, you have to write it almost like it's a blueprint. You know, it's not the actual, you know, this is why when you told me this, and it's in every filmmaking book, but Ed said it to me once and it really delivered well, that, you know, you make a film three times. You make it when you write it, you make it when you direct it, and then you make it when you edit it. And I love all three of those processes, if I'm honest with you. When I discovered how much I loved editing, it was an eye-opener that you could change so much of a story just by cutting it a certain way or just by making it a certain way. But, you know, when it comes down to it, writers, the biggest problem I have as a writer is the same one that lots of writers have that Mike's talking about here, and I think is really important, is that you have to be able to let it go. You know what I mean? It has to be what they need to take it and go somewhere with it, not the full thing. Because if it was the full thing, then you would be the director or the editor, but you're not. You know what I mean?
All the job would be done, you know, and we could.
So you've got to give it to them so they can visualize it. You know, they can see how this would be done. Because too often, and I'm guilty of this, like I said, too often you're giving like a shooting script, you know, and it's like, well, that's the director will do that. It's a
different thing,
You know, and it's, again, we talk about on this show is all about like, if you want these careers, because we do, at how many of these Zoom calls we do, you know, people are like, oh, I want to be a writer or I want to be a producer. Like, this is how you do it. Like, you have to learn, like Mike's saying, to do it the way a writer does it, not the way that you want to do it.
And the other reason
I guess I emphasize this is, in my day job, if I had any success, it was because I followed these kind of, you know, modicums, these kind of ideas. Yeah. It's not brain surgery, but don't fight against it. You know what I mean? Yeah. There is a method and a way to do this. I also agree with you, Mike, on the script writing competitions. I think the other reason is psychological. I use them because they give me a deadline and something to write, because otherwise, I mean, I can write about everything and anything, but it doesn't, you know, Ed will tell you this, like, there's a new pitch every day, but three quarters of the time, like, they disappear. And he's like, are you still working on that thing? And it's like, what thing? You know, and he's like, that one you pitched and you were really excited about and you had the whole
idea. He's always so excited.
And it's like, no, man, I don't even know where that is. I always write it down so I can find it and be like, oh, no, sorry, I just wasn't interested in it anymore. But, you know, as a writer, I think if you pick those competitions, it forces you to say, okay, I can have 100 ideas, but I need to pick one and take it through to completion.
I've never entered one of those competitions.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not someone who has honed my craft as a writer, I would say. I can write a story that I think might work. But I think that's one of the things that always impressed me a lot about you, Mike, is that, yes, you come from an acting perspective, and yes, you probably consider yourself a writer, but you're a very able like camera operator and editor, and like you remind me a little bit of the people that I kind of came up with in Korea, in the sense that we had to learn to do kind of everything, you know, regardless of the, from whatever perspective that we were kind of coming at it from, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's cool. I think that for any director, it's, you know, it's important. It's one of the reasons why I was so happy when Jason shot Dandelions, which, by the way, listeners, we're going to be in Romford this coming weekend. Is this coming out before? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right? Sorry. Big shout out for all of you listening, and we'll probably put another plug at the end of the show for it. But yeah, Romford Horror Festival is the 5th and 6th of June this weekend. It is, you know, it's still going on. It's going to have some COVID restrictions for the indoor thingy, but we will be there on the 5th. Our film plays circa 3 p.m., if I remember. Mm-hmm. It's in the short film showcase for all the quarantine films, and Ed and I will be there to talk about it and kind of describe things. We'll be around for the whole day just because it's, you know, it's run by Spencer Hawken, who, if I haven't mentioned to you on the show before, is another amazing filmmaker, guy who made Death Walks, the no-budget zombie film that everyone loves.
That's right.
You know, it's one of those things, guys. It's just great to see things opening up again. And we'll be there to kind of, you know, this very much should be the swan song for Dandelions, because it's not that I'm sick of talking about it, but I'm kind of sick of talking about it. You know what I mean? So,
but like, it's to my point that, like, I was so happy when Jason was like, I'm just going to film something, man. Like, I'm just going to film something with my kid and my wife and stuff. Because, like, you know, everything kind of opened up from then on, I feel. Jason, correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, he really kind of, you really took on that, you know, artistic perspective and understanding, like, the shots and the flow of the edit and, you know, all of those.
Maybe things. That's why, like, you know, for me, it's funny you say that, because usually, Ed, I am Mr. Business, right? I am Mr.
Right.
Objective position. I can tell you that's how I started in film, you know, wanting to be involved because of my desire, but, you know, really only being able to touch the surface of it because, you know, I'm just, that's how my day job is. Directing was what put me the full push. The thing that changed, you know, at least me, and said, no, this is like what I was meant to do. I think, like, this is what I like doing as an expression of me, you know, is creating films and making art this way. And yeah, I mean, Ed has said it a million times in this podcast, is the Beret moment, the French moment, but it really was for me. It was the moment.
I am an artist.
Yeah. I said, and it became just different for me. All of a sudden, stuff that I hadn't thought about before comes flooding back. And that's why now LVP, it's got this new content kind of flooding in, because Ed's on a creative bend, I'm on a creative bend, and we've realized that, like, that's all that really matters to us, is that we can get this stuff out and get it to people. I think, Mike, why I love having guys like you on the show is because even we suffer from this, but you still have to do it, you know? Yeah. Do it, do it, do it. The hardest thing in film, it's just like exercise to me. I remember just trying to be a fighter. It used to be the hardest point. You'd be so sore in the morning. You got to get up and do it again. You know what I mean? Yeah. You just got to keep doing it. And so that's, you know, Ed's coming over on Friday, and we're like, I don't care. We got to film something. I don't care if it's like a 2-second comedy sketch that we do right then and there. I've got a camera. I bought a camera like 6 months ago, and I want to use it. You know, it's not a good camera, but it's a camera, and it'll work, you know. And it's just, you got to keep those chops going. It's like, you know, before Michael and I were talking about, he's working on a quick and dirty, as we call them, you know, when you can just get done and shoot, you know. And it's funny, I just heard that again, Clapboard Jungle, Justin McConnell's story. He talks about those. He says you got to have those short films you can just drop and do something quick with. So yeah.
I think it's also not kind of, I used to put a lot of pressure on myself to, I've got to make something, and then I've got to do it quickly, because otherwise someone's going to think I'm not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I used to kind of shoot myself in the foot if I waited months and months. But actually, sometimes
you need it
on an idea, you know,
percolating.
Yeah, which is what I do with my ideas, you know. And then you'll go and you'll be filming something else, like Jason,
exactly,
doing something else, and that you'll come back to that idea.
Yeah,
it's almost, you know, it's got to be ready to go at the right time, and understanding that you don't have to make it by 25 or 30 or whatever, that you've got
right
time is a real opener. And then also to your point about Ed, about knowing a bit about everything. As a producer, I think you should have an understanding. And I always tell myself, I need an understanding of every person's job role so that I can talk to them on a level that they understand. Yeah. But in the back of my mind, I know I've picked them because they can do it better than I can.
Right.
No producer exactly. Everything that they can do everything more than
my one of my favorite things that someone told me was like, learn a little bit about every job, because when someone turns around and says to you, it's going to take this long, you can turn around and say, because I can do it in this amount of time, so you should be able to do it faster.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's not bad. That's not bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, knowing a little bit about everything, I think, just makes you a better producer, makes you a better actor, better director,
These are the things that are fresh on my mind, and because of what we're going through with you. So see, this is like, for me, first time encountering exactly what you're saying, Mike, the whole... Because again, it's 6 minutes, right? So it was like, oh, well, we could just make it. But then I looked at like all the different elements because of COVID, you know, luckily I think it was Humble Bundle. For £1, you get like 54 filmmaking books or something. But I'm always reading, you know, a different aspect. If it's, you know, 1 week it'll be about cameras, next week it's about sound. You know, yeah. I gave Ed this one about producing that was really good. But all the different areas, because, you know,
wait, do I have it?
No, okay. I didn't send it home with you. Producer, you haven't taken home yet. So
no, okay, good.
But you see the checklist on. But there's always
an area
that I'm kind of like getting into. And it's like the first thing I had to accept, I'm a know-it-all, Mike, as you know, because God knows poor Mike has had to sit through lots of these rants with me.
And listeners, you also know.
Yeah, you know-it-all. So the idea of finding someone that was better at anything than me was like, yeah, right. You know what I mean? Like, never going to happen. And film was one of the first things. It was like, you know, production design. I told you, Mike, like, I'm not the artist. You know what I mean? Like, I've got it in my head, and I know how it's supposed to look. But I am not a person that's created props and things like that. And I desperately need. And then all of a sudden you're like, but wait, like, I don't just want anybody to do this. Like, I want someone who's really good at it to do it. And then you're like, who do I know that's really good at this? You know, it's a
right.
Really,
and then you're like asking favors and, you know, it's that whole, you know, it's trying to like give birth to something. That's kind of how
and that's what I mean. I'm not saying in a bad way. Like it's what makes it so much fun. It's like, cause when you do deliver, when you've got that person that comes through and says, yes, I'll work on this with you. You're like, yes. You know what I mean? Like, we got the guy we needed for this. And that's the rush. That's making a film to me. That's why it's such a journey.
Which does bring up a question I wanted to ask. So one of my favorite things working on Shredders that you did was the amazing lookbook that you had, and also the model that you had made for the creature. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that and the process. Did you like ask an artist friend to do some sketches, or like how did it come about?
So after Darren got the script initially, and we were going through sort of rewrites, we started discussing kind of what me as a producer and what he as a director wanted, you know, and that. We did some very rudimentary sketches, which I'm sure I've got in a notepad somewhere.
Take pictures and send them, please.
I'll have a look around and find them. And I'm sure Darren will agree that they look nothing like the end creatures. But I started then saying, okay, well, look, if I want this to look a certain way, even if they're not in this short film, if I want to pick this, I need someone to create something that can really shine and show off what's in my head. And I found an artist called Rachel. She's called Alderson, or Aldersaw, sorry, is her artist name. And she does sort of graphics for games, and, you know, like if it's an icon on an RPG or something, she might do a little book or like things like that.
Okay, right.
And I kind of told her about the idea and said, look, this is what I'm doing. This is the short. This is the show to the script. And said, I'd really like for you to create a kind of character profile.
Did you know her previously? Or
No. I just searched for the kind of style I was looking for and found her website. And
okay, loved what cool.
She'd done. And started sketching some things. And I just thought, he's getting it. This is like, he's doing it. You know, he'd send me sketches of, oh, this is, I've studied these animals, gorillas or something like that. And, oh, I've got these different types.
Yeah, because she. I remember there were sketches of morphology, and because obviously, just for the listeners who might not know what a lookbook is, but it's essentially a kind of document or leaflet that is snazzy. It looks good. It has like artwork. It has descriptions, and just gives potential investors something to look at that will give them an idea for,
this is a practical, usable thing. So, I mean, just to let the listeners know, because this is also inside LVP and Posh Dinosaur Studio in this case.
That's right, baby.
Collaboration with Michael on this one. But, this is the lookbook and the statue we take around to, anywhere we can pitch it. I'd love to try to pitch it to like somewhere like Frontiers, but, if we could get distribution for someone like a can, the idea is you're going to take it and you're going to try to dev out first the script for the feature. So that's the first thing Mike and I will do, is go around and try to find someone that will give him some money to build out the feature. But then
this is ongoing, listeners. This is this project, although the short is done, it's the idea was always for it to lead in as a kind of calling card to show, well, look, this is it's almost like a short film lookbook kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Like
I mean, you have all the evidence you need to go to an investor and say, this is what it should look like. And we think it'll be a winner because, this was successful on this end. Or just look how this looks in the lookbook. It's one of those things with Shredders. It's just a matter of willpower on this. Mike and I would have loved to have done this before, and then COVID hits. And now it's, I think, been very much on our mind to say, well, what market should we be looking at for this one? Because you have to get in front to do that, but now we've got everything we need to do so. You know what I mean? I think the only trick with Mike was he wanted to think about, I think you were thinking about how the feature would actually go and kind of where you were happy with that. But the benefit you have, listeners, is it doesn't have to be 100%. When we're pitching, again, we're pitching for, money from Michael to be able to dev out the script. And then if they really like it, to give, his studio money to produce it, to make it. So it's a matter of, do you have a concept that's concrete enough for someone to hand you some money to do that?
Right. And evidence, right? The lookbook.
Right. And that's what I mean. The evidence isn't necessarily a completed script. The evidence is the lookbook. The evidence is the statue. The evidence is the concept that you're sure is going to make money, that you can relate to things. In this case, we've always, the creature features, the 80s throwback and all that have been popular, have been selling well. So these are the things you're going to do. The only other thing I would suggest, and Mike and I have talked about this before, I just haven't done it for Mike yet, so this is where I have to put my money where my mouth is, or at least my time where my mouth is a business plan will help with this as well. So if you put together a document, it is a proper business document. It's like 20, 30 pages, but that will outline exactly where you think things will go. And that's almost a step further than where we're at now. But the difference between that is you'll add a budget to that, or an expected budget and an idea of where you're going. But that's like the only other thing I can think of that you can throw on top of there. And then you've literally got anything and everything you'll need to talk to an investor.
To go to any meeting, any studio. The statue, because that was a cool moment. By the way, I recorded the moment when the statue was revealed. So we all gather at a really nice kind of Airbnb place where we were all staying together and stuff. And I think it was after the first day, wasn't it?
We did rehearsals, didn't we?
That's right.
I brought it up in the car. So I had you guys in the car if it's sitting there, because I went and picked it up downtown London and then drove it out to you guys.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Friday. Yeah. So, and it got brought downstairs to be revealed to the cast and crew, because no one had seen it but you guys. And you and Darren, you big pair of fucking pansies, start bawling your eyes out just from... No, it was beautiful. It really was. I'm kidding, of course. But it was, the cathartic moment of having the physical representation of all that effort and all that. It was a really cool moment. And hopefully when we do the feature and it goes on a DVD and stuff, I'll dig it up and we'll stick it on the extras.
Yeah, I think... I didn't expect quite react like that, obviously. I think it was taken so long to get to where we were with it, just with the script back and forth, as every project does. But it was also the fact that when we first started, I was sort of thinking, well, I'll never get a chance to show this in any way. This character, this, like you said earlier, animatronics is too expensive, things like that. So it was to see it and to see it how I imagined it the moment that I wrote it was really, really like emotional for me and kind of made me feel like, a bit like I was saying earlier, that my instincts were right. This is a good idea.
Must be very cathartic.
Yeah. And I always thought in my head, if I can create a creature that someone would buy as a little Funko Pop or have as a backpack or just put on their side like I do with all my stuff, then I'll be happy, because that's the kind of cult
design. That's the goal.
And to see this thing that was, for people that obviously won't have seen it, you know, it was up to
big boy.
Yeah, it was up to my waist. So I'm 5'10", so it was huge. And the Maximal Effect was the name of the artist that made it. The teeth looked like teeth, the eyes, I mean, it looked like it was gonna move. It just didn't.
Oh yeah, it looked I mean, that's the thing. That's why, you know, and this is what happens, viewers or listeners, I should say, like, you know, it sits on a shelf for a while because we just haven't taken it out of storage. But this is there to be out and wow people kind of when they see it. So it's a really good thing to bring up, Ed, because it's just, once you have those things done, they're at your disposal. You know what I mean? And that's why it was always so awesome that Mike had it done. Because if you don't have those things, then you're pitching something that's more thin air. And I'm not saying you can't do that. You know, Mike's good at pitching stuff he's got as a concept. I've tried to develop that myself, so is Ed. But it's the kind of thing that if you can show somebody, then wow, then all of a sudden you've just got them that much more. Those tangible things, that much more there.
Well, it's exactly. It's a gamble, isn't it? Making a film. It's a gamble for an investor.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't just, if going up to an investor and saying, I've got this script, do you want to make it, put loads of money.
Here are some words on a page.
You might as well go down to the high street and ask someone for some money, because it's basically the same. But going to someone and saying, I've got this evidence here. This is what it's going to look like. This is what we filmed. This is what we've written. This is how much it's going to cost. It's like, suddenly it's not as much of a gamble.
Right.
They can make an informed decision on whether they want to, you know, take a punt on that. And if you don't have that, you may get there, but it's just going to be so much
harder.
That's, I mean, and that's why I talk about the business plan as well, because that's the last bit. You know what I mean? That's when you're literally saying that any investor, you know, sophisticated or otherwise, can look at what you've got and kind of get it done that way. So, and it's just interesting to me. It's hard because in creative spaces like film and, you know, music's the same way. Like, there's a want to not do it by the book, and I get it. Like, there's a want to do it your way and want to do it indie and whatnot. And like, don't get me wrong, like, I grow my hair out long for you guys for all that. But you know what I mean? The other side of me says, but I also want to get it done. And so to get it done, do it by the book. You know what I mean? This is why, you know, incorporate to make your films and stuff like that. Like, why? Because when you want to get, you know, the whole reason you're doing this is you either want someone to make your idea or pick you up so you can make one of their ideas. And either way, you want it to look slick. You know what I mean? You want it to get done. People are going to give you money the slicker it looks. And so that's just kind of all part and parcel of it. You know what I mean? Can I ask,
how much did it cost to get, like, physically made?
So that cost around £650, because which was a lot cheaper than it would be. The artist sort of said, you know, I really like this art. I'll do it just for the cost of making it. Based on the idea that then, you know, if it went on, obviously I'd be like, well, she made it.
Yeah, of course.
Making it and things like that. I mean, and, you know, I think I had conversations with some people that there was a company that worked on a Sky One production. I don't know what it was now. Like, one where this mum goes to like a fairy tale land or something. She's got to get her kids back or something. I'd spoken to them, they'd seen the script, they really liked it, and they said, you know, we could do it, but the amount of money it was, I mean, the guy had worked like Jim Henson, so he was like, this could be done this way, but the amount of money it was, until you get that money, you can't,
we can't
do anything, which is always the case, the same as when I was, I wrote a script, a feature film version of Already Dead, which I still have, and I think I might go back to, because it's likely to do with pandemic-y stuff, so it
And we've all got one in the pocket.
Yeah, yeah. And I was actually in talks to get the guy who plays Rimmer from Red Dwarf.
Okay.
He'd read it and said he was interested in being it, but I just couldn't get the money for it. You know,
yeah.
Couldn't get the money behind that, which was a shame because it would have been great.
Is this for the already dead feature film?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I've slightly gone off point here. I can't remember what.
No, but you see that, like, I just saw that. I've been talking about Platform Jungle because I just watched it again recently. But Jess McConnell has that on his big one. He finally gets to make the whole documentary is about him trying to make. And I still haven't watched it. I feel bad for the guy, Will. But he has this deal where it's like he's got the actor he wants, but the actor will only sign if they give the money. And they'll give the money, but they'll only give the money if the actor will sign. Yeah. And it's just a horrible circle. I mean, this is 5 years before he finally gets the deal through. This is the whole point of watching the Platform Jungle, understanding just how hard it is to set these deals up. But that's, again, going, I mean, you've had a really good show with this one, Mike, because we're kind of putting it all back together. That is why your shit needs to be straight. Your shit needs to be tight. You know what I mean? Mm. And Michael can tell you, because he's produced with me, I don't practice what I preach all the time. You know, Shredders was not done. And I'm honest about this, Mike. On my end, you know, as tight as I would have liked, and I had some things going on that year, and Mike and I are friends. So, you know, he's never kind of begrudged me the fact that we didn't lock it in as tight as it could be. But that's what we mean. Like, you've got to get as much in front of it so that when Mike goes out and tries to get an investor on it, or I go out and try to get an investor, there's no questions. It's there. It's done. And it's ready to go. Why do you do that? Well, because you were going out there, you know, Mike, how many other creature feature scripts are we competing against with this, do you think?
Oh, God.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the first thing a confident writer will tell you is, like, we're confident about our own writing, but you also understand that there's a billion other writers out
competition
there that have good ideas. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's whoever gets there first with the particular idea. So you've got to do everything you can to make it easy, you know, make it a slam dunk. Oh, well, great concept, already set up, let's get it done.
And sometimes it does mean spending money on, you know, like a statue for the thing, and getting the lookbook, like, you know, getting a graphic designer to make it look good and stuff like that. I mean, those are things that, you know, very quickly when you want to raise the quality of your work, you know, unfortunately, money is the thing that...
It's an interesting thing, right? Because people come to us and sometimes want to make it on a no budget. Because, like, we understand you don't have money, Jason. I'm like, well, yeah, you don't have my money, at least. Like, I'll pitch to anybody you want, you know what I mean? But I won't put my own doubloons in someone else's
And money. To be fair, you are actually very generous with, like, backing people's...
Oh, I am. Yeah, if I like your concept and you've like sold me on it, then sure, I'll contribute. But you know what I mean? Like, I've not got doubloons to be funding anybody's expeditions. But like Mike does, like, if we needed $650, you know, to buy a prop and we didn't have it anywhere else, well, you got to do what you got to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I'll find it somehow. You know what I mean? I'll make it happen. But it's that, I guess that's my point. Like, then I talk to other guys, and they're usually young guys, so I'm not knocking you guys, 20-year-old guys that are, you know, and girls, that are sitting there wanting to do zero budget everything and then don't want to drop a dime of their own money. A, because maybe they're like, well, I don't make enough money in my own job, or I want to buy this video game. And it's like, you don't understand. Like, you've got to start taking some of that money from your day job. I do this with my day job and start contributing to what you need to do. Because it's not, I mean, you can do no budget, but if you want to start getting quality stuff out there, you do need money. Like,
I always see it as like an investment in us, you know, in yourself, you know, when you're painting, you're also learning the process, you know now how it works in going back and forth with an artist for concept art. You know, you now know what it's like to go back and forth with a sculptor or like a maker studio,
right?
And get something done. So I always see it as an investment in your education, your career and your future. So I've never been reticent to, like, you know, be like, okay, I need to spend some money here, you know?
No, I mean, most recent for us was the t-shirts for this podcast. So, you know, I typical Jason fashion, I promised everybody the moon, you know, and said I'd get everyone t-shirts, and I hadn't actually gone through the process of how do I do that. So I had a logo. Thankfully, I've got a really nice guy, Eric Johansson. Thank you so much, that creates the logos and stuff like that for us. And he does that for free for us, which is just ridiculously awesome.
Amazing. Just because he likes the podcast. What
yeah, just because, you know, and the amount of brunches I owe this guy because of it, ridiculous.
It's but okay. He's a Swede. He'll take meatballs.
Meatballs. But, you know, we had to put them on a T-shirt. I'd never done that before. And then I saw how much it cost to get it all done. You know, of course, and then I also had my wife try to tell me I was doing it all wrong, which is, you know, that's fine. But then I ordered and paid the money. It's fine. You know, minor heart attack over. People are all going to get their T-shirts. And then they...
I contributed. Important.
Ed did. Otherwise, I might get in trouble at the end of the month this month. But
that's right.
You know, when the T-shirts arrived, it was surreal how awesome it felt. It's like just cool, surreal.
Right? I still haven't got mine.
Look, it's on the. This sounds really not how it's supposed to sound, but I've laid it out on the guest
bedpost
that's coming over this week. Exactly.
And he expects me to wear nothing else, people.
Paint me like one of your French girls.
Oh, if only that were true, right?
Stop it. Just stop it.
All right.
All right. Yes. How are we doing on time?
How are we doing on time? Oh, he's turning red from all these questions, and he's asking.
Not at all.
We're good. We're good. We are just about at an hour and a half. So Ed's right to say we should probably start winding it up before we just start talking all night. Ed's also probably catching me from the screen here that I'm about to pass out because I've been up since 7 on my day.
I've got to get up like. You know,
and that's right. Ed crazy. I decided we should do the podcast the day before he's going into his job tomorrow. So, you know, you show up at the stack tomorrow, and the guy sleeping behind aisle 2 is Ed Burgos.
Row E. Yeah. Thank you so much, though, Mike. I mean, you know, we've really missed you during the pandemic. It's kind of been one of the things that we've talked a lot about. Of like, you know. The people that we've loved collaborating with and we want to do more with. So, and you're like right at the top of that list. So thank you so much. Thank you for being so funny with your, you know, with your writing and stuff, because I see a great future for you, dude.
Oh, thanks.
Any other shout outs or connects or anything like that, Mike?
Give us your socials and stuff.
So do you want to shout out to anything?
Try and remember my shout outs now. See, I've got Abdul Chowdhury that I've spoken about before, Darren A. Furness, Ricky J. Payne, Felipe Pereira, Sophie Mensa, who was obviously on the show a couple of weeks ago, Darren Ruston, and literally everyone that I've ever sort of worked with. You know, thanks for helping me and for being awesome on all the sets. I mean, you can find Posh Dinosaur Productions on YouTube. Just type in Posh Dinosaur Productions, just see the nice orange dinosaur at the top. You can watch all of my stuff there.
Yeah, check out Cupid, check out Already Dead.
If you do want to follow me on Instagram, I don't post that often, but it's MichaelJDay_film. I think I changed it recently, but you'll find me on there. You'll see my ugly mug on there.
Stop it, you beautiful bastard. if no one gets to see the video of this, like, Michael is a looker.
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting thirsty.
Ooh. I won't make any noises.
You know, we're the hottest Spice Girl when you combine the studios, Posh Victoria. You know what I mean?
That's right. That's right.
And thanks to you too. It's been a crazy couple of years, and you know, I've enjoyed not only being on the show today, but our last collaboration, and I'm sure many, many more.
Mike, when we finally get that studio and everything, and we're all looking back, because I there's going to be a bunch of us with this. I don't think any of us will believe how we actually got there, but. Doing the journey with you and with Ed is just the best part of it, man. So thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you so much, man. We're going to have, I'm telling you, the best is still to come.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do we need to do our socials, Producer Jay?
Sure. We can do if you would like. I love this because Ed hates doing them. So he's going to
fucking hate them. Yeah.
Do. So before we sign off completely, then remember the best way to get a hold of everything with us is www.lovevictoriaproductions.com. That has Dirty 20, that has What Are You Guys Talking About, that has all our short films, has what we're working off. As long as I get permission from Lori, we're going to put some dev diary stuff up on there for what we're doing for What Are You Guys, You Reap What You Sow. But it is the best way. Other way that's really easy to get a hold of us is Facebook. Ed and I both have personal pages. We also have one for Love Victoria Productions. We have Instagram, so you have Jazzy J. Chiro and Enano LVP. Or you can just check us out on Twitter with @AnoskiProd. That's his old production company. Or @MouthLoveVictoria. I wish more people did that. I really am Mouth, guys. So just can we just play into that more, please? You know, more Twitter feeds for Mouth. And then finally on LinkedIn, we have the professional page, which will always have the same post we have on all the other bits of social media. But please check us out. Like I said, the whole point is that we have a lot of things that we offer. So if you like this, you're likely to like Dirty 20 as well, or possibly the Carnivale lore videos, which is Ed with his really scary voice doing fun stuff. So just check it out, folks. It's something you might enjoy, might have more content for you while you're still semi-stuck at home as we get towards the ends of COVID here.
Yes, and if you haven't checked out the spring one-shot that we did for Dirty 20, please go ahead and do that. This week, we're releasing a video where I talk about how I came up with it and stuff, so that should be a good one.
Oh, very good, very good. Yes, it still has to be released because I've been under the cosh at work, so...
I know, it's okay.
Producer Jay will get it up after this podcast tonight. All right. Well, thank you all listening for very much. And thank Mike for joining us today. We'll be back next week. Actually, I'm excited on Thursday, or is it Friday? We say we do it on Friday. I think it's Friday. We're going to be recording live from the couch, folks, live from my couch. And it's going to be right after I'm forcing Ed to watch The Love Witch because I effing love that film. And we're going to talk about it on the podcast. And I have a funny feeling Ed's not going to love it as much as I am. So I really want to get his immediate reaction before he can be really nice and be like, no, it was a great film, Jay.
And then maybe we should do a like a little snippet at the Romford Film Festival.
We will.
If we get the chance.
We'll do something. We'll do some TikTok style videos.
Yeah, exactly. Do like a little dance.
Exactly. We'll do the COVID-19 film.
James Dean, I know just what you mean.